This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show with me, Alison Spittle. Very happy to have you here. This week's guest is an American called Guy Branum. He was over in London for a few weeks visiting Europe. He is a fantastic comedian, an actor and author. A great book called My Life as a Goddess, which I listened to on Spotify. Not on Spotify, that's a different app. I listened to it on Audible, and it was really, really enjoyable. He's a really, really emotionally intelligent man and just plain intelligent. And I was very, very delighted to interview him. Thanks very much to the Phoenix Arts Club who facilitated a space where I could interview him. And go listen to this, and then I'll have a chat with you after about what I'm up to. Okay? Chat soon. This is the
File.
The thing, one of the things I love most is that people, like, if Americans pay any attention at all to a world outside of their own, people act like we're being the most generous in the world.
And I
think I've gotten a little addicted to that feeling from Canadians, because they are just so thankful if you know that they exist.
No, it totally is that way. It's totally that way. I listened to your book on audiobook.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. So you were talking about, like, Canada, and I was like, you got a whole chapter of that. They must be so happy.
Well, I like, it is one of the strange things about the book is, like, I'm like, I talk some shit about a bunch of things, but the things that people are most offended by is, how do you have an entire chapter that's just about Canadian history? Why did you expect us to read that?
Really?
Yeah. And it's like,
but I liked it because it was different to, like, I really love the chapters where you're like, you know, because I listened to it because I was like, oh, he's going to dish some shit on what it's like to be a writer in American TV. So, like, I loved that bit. But then I was like, I wasn't expecting Canada.
Well, I was just like, it's my book. You're coming to my territory. Mm. And, like, to understand me is to understand all of the shit that I just pay too much attention to.
Yeah, I'm massively into trivia as well.
Yeah.
Like, me and my boyfriend were going out 7 years, but the first holiday we went to, we went over to London to watch a quiz being filmed.
Oh, which one?
Pointless. I love Pointless. Oh. Have you seen Pointless?
I have not seen Pointless.
It's a great game. It's, you have to get the most, not only do you have to get it right, but you have to get the most obscure answer.
Oh, I heard somebody talking about that. I've been obsessively watching Only Connect.
Oh, you're so intelligent.
No. Victoria Corn Mitchell is just, I love her so much. And then I always watch University Challenge. But it's funny because I have to watch them on YouTube, and YouTube has just been taking me to, like, other quiz stuff. So then, like, you end up watching, like, the, like, funny Christmas people from a different show are on Countdown. And, like, I did not know what Countdown was, but I had to write stuff about a video game that was based on Countdown.
Whoa.
For, like, a job I had years ago. And then when I finally saw it, I was like, what a bad game show.
I know. It's just because it's so old at this stage. Like, it's just always, I'm there. I'm good at the math round, but I'm terrible at getting words together.
I mean, like, the fact that you just, like, sit and watch people do math.
I know.
Is, like, ridiculous, though it is kind of cool. Like, I'm bad at both rounds. Like, on Only Connect, I'm terrible at the hidden vowels round.
Yeah.
And, like, some of these, I'm like, well, I have to watch them enough that I can be better at them now. But I do love, there are so many goddamn game shows on here.
There are so many. Yeah, you presented, like, a game show, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was really fun. So, like, I, during, like, a low point in my career, I had this,
I love those parts.
I had this idea that had been floating around in my head since law school of, like, a talk show that is a game show, like a competitive talk show where you earn points by doing what you're supposed to do on a talk show. So I asked some of my friends, like Retta from Parks and Recreation, and what are The reason I'm doing this is because on the show you would earn points for name dropping.
Yeah.
or Academy Award winner Diablo Cody. And I just like started doing it as a live show in LA. And one of the wonderful things about LA is like you can do just like a shitty live show in a shitty venue and it will turn into a TV show.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I got to do two seasons of it for True TV, and then it got canceled. And so
it burned bright for a quick amount of time.
Well, it was also really cool to have something that was just like, here's my idea, and to take it through the whole process.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit, you know, it made me sad because there is this way in LA, one of the bad parts of LA is that like everybody is constantly big dealing, and so you're always like, do I matter enough to be having this conversation or whatever? And like when you have a TV show, all of that just breezes away and you're like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you must have, I mean, there must have been like 15 great months of walking around Ireland being like, why, yes, yes. It is Allison.
No, totally. Yes. Or do you know what the best bit was? The months before. Because it was the potential. And it was the, oh, she's got a TV show coming out on. And then it comes out. And then like, you know, people then go, when is the next series coming out? And you're like, oh, I don't know.
Right.
Until it became such amount of time between another series being announced and the series happening that it looks less and less likely.
Yes.
So eventually, like I've only told people that publicly this week that it's being cancelled.
For me, there were like 3 or 4 weeks where I knew and I was like, we're trying to sell it somewhere else, blah, blah, blah. And then it was like, oh, what's the right way to say this? And like, I had to tell my writers, you know, like privately, and I didn't do that to two of my writers, which was half of my writers' room. It was terrible.
Yeah.
But still, at this point, like, there is also the nice thing of like benchmarks, and you must be like, that this has happened must mean that you feel like you can breeze into any show in Ireland and be like, yes, Alison Spittle is here. She would like to go.
Yeah, I suppose. It's just moving over here. It's different. Mm-hmm. And I'm living in a house with like 6 other people.
Yeah.
And like, I'm kind of like, just life is starting over again. And it's weird, but I like it.
Well, you know? One of the things that's really important in LA is
people
get this concept of who they should be after one success. And like that can really destroy people because,
oh my gosh,
they're not willing to sort of like buckle down and do the work. And they're like, oh, I should be bigger than this. And the thing is for people who have been in LA for a while, the stories of like valiant behavior are always like, what's her name? The redheaded lady from The Office.
The one in Kimmy Schmidt?
Not Ellie Kemper.
Jenny Fisher?
I forget her name.
Is she an older lady?
Yes.
Yes, I know who she
is. But the point is that she kept her job as a waitress until like the 3rd season of The Office.
And whoa.
Those are the people who you always have to be like super respectful of in LA. Or she's on the Golden... being so bad about not remembering people's names, but she's on The Goldbergs. She was in Bridesmaids.
Blonde lady.
Yes.
I know who she is. Okay. She's amazing.
And she's wonderful. She did talk show at the game show, but I'm not saying her name, so I won't get points for name dropping. But like, she was telling me, like, she kept her job editing an academic journal at Cal State Long Beach, like, through being in Bridesmaids. Like, she on like when they would go back to their trailers on Bridesmaids, she would do her day job.
No.
And that thing of like, you keep your day job, like you have understand that you have to do the work. And the thing is like, there was definitely a point in my time where I was like, do I have to go be a lawyer again? Do I have to go work at a law firm and sort of like do that thing? And I instead survived by just doing the shittiest of writing jobs.
Yeah.
But that's also just a different kind of survival and understanding like, I'm not a big deal. I'm just a person who's working.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Like when you say shitty writing jobs, are these like the kind of award shows and stuff? Or
I mean, the thing is like those can be annoying, but also are super fun.
Okay.
Like the thing is like, yeah, I fucking worked the VMAs in a way. Like one of the years that I've ended up working on the VMAs a couple of years. But one of them, it was just like, I had just moved back from New York and I like didn't have an apartment yet. I had a bunch of laundry I needed to do, and I was just working this shitty job that was too many hours, and just like, it was a slog. It's like writing 1,000 introductions for Bruno Mars that are in no way funny. But the rest of the room was these wonderful people, and it was super funny. And while I was at that job, I got a DM from Mindy Kaling, and she was like, hey, are you working right now? And I was like, nope.
Oh my God.
She was like, want to come work for me? And I was like, yup.
And that job that you did for Mindy sounds like an amazing job, because you were punching up jokes on a storyline that's already happened.
It was that's wonderful. No, like that was the best thing, is that usually when people start at the beginning of a season, you like sit down and like the grown-ups are supposed to talk and you're supposed to be quiet.
Yeah.
And it's hard for people to learn, because like on a late night room in the United States, everybody pretty much is just supposed to pitch jokes regardless of rank. But in a scripted room, when you're talking about story, you're supposed to be pretty quiet, you know, and just listen and learn. But I got to show up in the middle of things when they already had scripts that were done and just needed punch up. And the thing is like, getting to have good jokes come out of your mouth is such a nice way of proving to the rest of the room why you're there.
Yeah.
Like when you like sit there like a lump for 4 weeks before you get a chance to say a joke, and like learning how to sort of like jump into the double dutch of it and like not interrupt people or whatever.
Yeah.
Like super hard. So that was super nice. And there's also in the same way that like with stand-up, when you're dealing with new people, you can be a little bit like cold to them.
Totally.
But then once you get to realize that they're funny, you like warm up.
All the time.
Right. The Mindy Project was such a nice, like, they wanted to be supportive, but at the same time, they expected work out of you. And they were like great people who had come from The Simpsons and The Office. Like everyone in that room, except for me and my friend Chris, had an Emmy.
Wow.
Or lots of Emmys. And it was just like hard and terrifying.
That's amazing. That's like, I'm trying to think of have you ever done a lot of when I listened to your book, you were talking about doing Chelsea Lately and having a lot of side projects and kind of juggling with that.
Yeah.
And what was it like to kind of like have a writer's room job and kind of push for yourself?
Well, a lot of people stop doing that. A lot of people get into the comfort of a writer's room and like they start feeling like self-conscious about pushing themselves. And for me, it's just I have different parts of myself that need to be taken care of, like and another thing is I was always aware of the fact that like gay men in stand-up get pushed out of performance. Like there aren't any major gay male stand-up comedians in the United States.
You're right. Oh my God.
And I remember I was watching The Daily Show like a decade ago, and Jon Stewart was interviewing Michael Patrick King.
Yeah.
And they were talking, and then they started talking about doing stand-up together, and I was like, oh hey, wait, why didn't I ever get to see that guy do stand-up? You know, he's like gay guy, created Two Broke Girls and like was showrunner of Sex and the City. Mm. And just sort of realizing like that town is always gonna be like, you go write a sitcom for a woman. That's your job. And the thing is I fucking love writing a sitcom for a woman. It's a great thing, but also like I gotta do my thing. And the wonderful thing is like in so much of my career, Chelsea put me on the show, like Mindy, like it was the Mindy writer's room was very unusual because there were two gay men there that usually you're the one.
There could only be one.
Yes. And Mindy at some point in time was like, what if we had two gossipy nurses who were named Chris and Guy?
Ah, that's so cool.
And, you know, it's wonderful. And it's also just nice to like leave your job and be like, fuck that, I'm gonna go think about something else.
Yeah.
And I think being in the scrappy world, I mean, the thing is that a writer's room is full of people who have $3 million houses in Pacific Palisades where you can smell the ocean. And a comedy show is full of dudes who do not have dental care.
No.
and I think it's good to go hang around with 27-year-old boys who don't have dental care.
Yeah.
And I use boys in the broadest sense of the term, because a significant number of the boys in LA are girls these days. But just sort of it's good to keep that scrappiness in mind.
So are you doing stand-up while you're over in the UK? Do you plan to? Or?
I have a couple of shows, and the thing is I didn't want to do anything official, like sort of like try to book anything in that way.
Yeah.
Because I knew that like my reps would be bad at doing that. Like there are some management companies, like Avalon is here. So like people who are rep by Avalon are always coming here and doing runs at this Soho Theater or whatever. But I just, in the same way that like when I come to a town, I want to eat in good restaurants. I want to have anonymous sex with gay guys and I want to do some shows, you know?
You
want to like feel the town out.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to do that because there's also the way that like getting to touch and play with a different kind of audience is always so interesting.
Mm.
Like, you know, going to different parts of the United States, getting to go to like the gentle, delicate audiences of Canada who like, you know, want to be loved but can also be easily scared.
Yeah.
And it was just, or like, you know, coming from Los Angeles, when you go to New York, you deal with these audiences that like push back and have opinions and like, it's wonderful. It's like, and so just, I'm like excited and scared about like, what are these British audiences going to be like, oh, I have actually performed in Britain once before.
Oh.
Here's how. So like, there's this really great podcast producer in LA who came from the BBC. His name is Colin Anderson.
Right.
And he one day was like, hey, do you want to do this show where people Skype in from other countries? It was on BBC Radio. And it was so wonderful because it was an audience full of like older BBC people.
Yeah.
And I did one sort of like, here's a joke for you, Britain. I did one joke that I did that and they just thought, they ate it up. Yay. And then I did one that was sort of like a, I'm going to call you out, Britain kind of thing. And they were just like, nope. And I was like, okay. I've pushed too far.
Yeah. What were you calling them out on?
Well, the first one was I said that.
I have that too, by the way, where I've called Britain, like, and the audience would be like, ooh, because I bring up the IRA.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, no, but I forget, like, the IRA did bomb them.
Well, no, mine was also, like, a very questionable area of, I essentially said, like, all of their greatest victories from World War II were because they had Canadians and Australians to throw at the problem.
Right. They do not like that.
No.
You cannot touch World War II or Princess Diana.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
I know.
Yeah.
Because she's so great and, like, you know, you can, especially as a child of divorce, like I just love the royals' divorces.
I mean, the thing is at the end of the day, Camilla Parker Bowles got what she wanted.
She played the long game. The very long game.
And like, Diana was always a little bit like, be sad for me. Wah, wah. Like,
really? Are you a Camilla person, would you say?
Sort of. I mean, it's so funny. So like, my undergraduate thesis in history was on the British royal family and media relations. And
no.
I declared that to my advisor. And then a week later, Princess Diana died. And so it was like amazing because all of my research was essentially done for me by the media, just sort of like throwing down with all this stuff. And so I was able to go through it and it was wonderful. But like, I think she was amazing, but also like, why is this the transitional figure who we hook on? I mean, her dad was the Earl of Spencer. Where like somebody like, you want to know who I love? Fucking Meghan Markle. Meghan Markle got what she wanted. And I don't know if she'll be able to stay on that mechanical bull, but as long as she stays on that, I'm just so impressed that she's on it.
I kind of hope they get divorced and she can be the Fergie that we all deserve. You know what I mean?
But I also think both she and Kate watch the game play out and, like, Meghan Markle's fucking smart.
Yeah.
Like, even just the thing, even just her as a fucking Angelino looking around LA and saying, I'm not going to be a big enough deal to be a big deal here. Fucking going to Toronto, getting Canadian citizenship so she could be a local hire.
That's crazy.
I mean, she's a calculating bitch. And that I love. I love people who, like, take control of their own destiny, you know?
Yeah. That's incredible. I didn't know she did that.
Yes.
That's incredible.
No, it's wonderful.
What about, what's your opinion on Fergie? Because I feel like if you were doing that master's then, or, you know, you would have, she would have been the big kahuna at the time, I mean, before Diana.
She's a mess. But she's such a lovable mess. And I like the fact that she, like, Fergie is not calculating, but she lands on her feet.
Okay.
You know, like, she fucking Weight Watchers endorsement deals. Like, she was one of the first people to figure out writing children's book is a great way of cashing in on celebrity without having to have a skill.
Yeah.
Like, I just think she's, like, a bit of a mess. Also, I remember we had, like, a couple of really good TV movies that came out, first about Diana and then about her. But yeah. I remember, like, so obsessively watching the TV movie about her and her complaining about how she didn't have as much money for dresses as Diana did. And then that led me to down the hole of, in a pre-internet world, trying to figure out what the income differences between the Prince of Wales and other royal princes was.
How would you even get that information at that point?
I mean, at that point in time, like, it wasn't until, it seriously was, like, only when I was at Berkeley that I was like, which is the university I went to, that I was like, oh.
Sorry, yeah, I'm like, I've listened to your books, so I'm like, yes, go on.
But, like, then when I was doing research, it was like, oh, the Duchy of Cornwall gives a significant income to the Prince of Wales.
Right. Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, the world was, I don't know how old you are, but I am definitely not asking you to say it on a podcast. I'm from Los Angeles, and I have respect, okay?
I think people will be, like, forever 29, especially if you're fat as well.
Yes.
You know, it's beautiful.
No, I mean, people have no sense of how old I am. And when I tell them, they're always, like, slightly horrified. And I'm like, best to just avoid it.
Yeah.
But also, in Los Angeles, no one should ever publicly say their age.
Yeah.
It's just defend your brand. but living in a pre-internet world, like, you were just constantly like, how am I going to figure this out?
Yeah.
Is the right book in this room? And, like, it's just so nice now that you can just be like, hey, the internet, tell me a story.
A big thing, this is totally going off topic, but a big thing I ask all my guests is, have you ever been to a Denny's? And what is it like?
Is this only for Americans?
No, for every, because I've never been to America.
Oh,
and
okay.
I even ask, like, Irish people or English people.
That's amazing. Okay, so after this, we have to talk about your conceptions of America. Because I'm essentially on my reverse version of that journey where I'm like, you know, yesterday and today I had full English breakfast for the first time. And it was like, what a lovely idea. If they put salt and pepper on it, it would be good.
Yeah, in Ireland, we have better sausages than in England. I feel like they're almost like sausage meat in a condom here. It's just very thick.
No,
I do not like it.
The sausages are very strange. Okay,
yes.
A Denny's.
Okay.
So like, Denny's growing up in like a working class family was completely, we're on a car trip. That's a solid option, but you always look for something better.
Yeah.
In my book, I describe Perkins, the sort of like
the mother that loved it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perkins is a Denny's.
I've never heard of a Perkins, so yeah.
The thing is Perkins is good. Like, they take pride in their pancakes and stuff like that. Where like Denny's is just brass tacks truth. And the thing about Denny's is it's so cheap. Like, Denny's is just a transcendent level of cheapness. And the thing is, but Denny's is also, if you ignore their sketchy history on race.
Oh, I did not know that. Oh,
it was like a running problem of Denny's not seating African-American guests.
I'm finding out it's problematic.
Yes. The thing is that a Denny's is like a solid answer. And there was somebody who was telling a story about a Denny's that has a full bar, which does seem like a compelling concept.
Yeah.
But the thing is like a Denny's is, it's where high school kids go because it's like the only thing that's going to be open 24 hours in your town. And it's like a Denny's is solid work. A Denny's is always going to be providing you with a diner experience, but there is nothing good about a Denny's.
Yeah.
Though, can I tell you?
Yes.
My hometown, we had a Denny's but then our other sort of like breakfasty diner place, because breakfasty diners of that sort are very much a California phenomenon.
Okay.
Like they're just like, they're laid out and they're flat.
Yeah.
And there are lots of booths. When you come to Los Angeles, give me your hand, Allison Spittle.
I'll take you.
When you come to Los Angeles, I will take you to the Burbank Bob's Big Boy.
Yeah.
Which is a burger place with a very similar layout. And that will, it is the most California experience that you can have.
But it's good food.
It's wonderful.
Okay. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
But my hometown had a diner like that that was better than the Denny's.
Yeah.
But its name was a racial slur for African Americans.
No.
Yes.
No. My God.
Yes.
And when did that name end?
And like it disappeared at some point in time by like the late 80s.
Yeah.
But it was really where I went with my dad and sister after a soccer game or whatever.
Oh my gosh. In Ireland, we had an ice cream that was like a racial slur for a black person.
Yes.
And it was vanilla. It was a weird, and that didn't end. I remember it.
It's one of those things of like, you're 7 years old, you're not asking questions about it. It's just the name of the diner. And then I noticed that like my mom referenced the story that it was referencing.
Right.
And I was like, and then she explained it to me, and then not long after that, the place didn't exist anymore.
Good. Oh my gosh.
But it was, it's weird when you realize that those remnants are just sort of laying around. One of the lovely things about being in California is that like everyone showed up to California in 1964, so you don't really have there just isn't much space for sort of like ethnic anger or like racism of the deeply explicit kind that you get in like on the East Coast.
Okay,
like, it's just sort of like, you know, implicit fabric of America racism.
Right,
And then a lot of drive-throughs.
When it comes to understanding political issues, I am a self-confessed toddler. That's why I've enlisted the help of Steve, my politically savvy drinking buddy, to help me better understand politics.
Every couple of weeks, we get together and record on topics like what is the politics of language, what is Watergate, how the internet is killing democracy.
We take these big issues and we break them down into silly little comedic bite-sized bits. If you like the sound of that, then search for What Am Politics in your podcast app of choice or find us here on the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Tell me about your concept of what America is like.
So my concept of what America is like is like a lot of barbecue sauce.
Uh-huh.
Free coffees.
Yes.
You know, so like a lady walking around in like a check skirt and like a cigarette in her mouth and glasses like mine and just giving people free coffees. And what else? That there's a dream that like poor people can be rich.
Oh, that is interesting because, having been in London for 2 or 3 days, like there is a population of homeless people, but it isn't like what you get in California.
Right.
And so remembering, or like every time I go to Canada and seeing that like the homeless people have like proper health care and wheelchairs and stuff like that. And like California just, or the United States, we just like, we don't have a social net the way that you guys do. It is like you fell or, you know, we're systematically like excluded from our economic system. We're not going to help you out at all.
Yeah.
But the mind fuck of convincing everybody that if you just play your cards right, you could somehow be a millionaire is like, it's the greatest trick America pulled. Like I'm from is this like rural area in California the thing is, and I say California and you're like Hollywood.
Beautiful.
The thing is like where I'm from is further away from Los Angeles than Edinburgh is from London. You know?
Right,
like
okay,
it's
yeah.
very far. I checked that this morning so I could properly like lay that out. But like the thing is all of those people who are currently in the fires in like Chico and stuff, they're all of these people who because of that dream of like of richness are like, I don't need a government. Stay away from me.
Yeah.
And then when all of the untended forests around them catch on fire and there's nobody there to help them.
Yeah.
It's like, what do you do?
What? That's That's fucked up.
It is.
And the whole getting prisoners to volunteer to be firefighters is odd.
It's horrifying. I have to say, I mean, there are some truly great things that America has done. But when I heard, okay, so like Mississippi and Alabama, yeah. Places that have a complex history when it comes to unpaid labor. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So they started being very active about deporting Mexicans and Central Americans who had come to do farm labor,
right.
And arresting a lot of them. And then there was no one to do the farm labor. So then they started getting prisoners, some of whom were these people who had come to do paid farm labor, to do the farm labor and not be paid because they were prisoners. And, you know, the thing about racism in America is that it convinces wide swaths of people that stuff like that isn't their problem because, like, wouldn't happen to me. I'm white.
Yeah.
And they sort of don't understand that those tools are also being used to oppress them. You know, like, where I'm from, I mean, it is racially diverse, but it's also full of a lot of working class white people who don't see the ways that they don't get to participate in their own self-governance,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But there is the off chance that they can become rich, usually through swindling the government. Like,
really?
All of the, like, there are, like, this, like, strip of, like, five big houses in my little town, and, like, three of the five houses, the people were convicted of lying to the government about, like, the Department of Agriculture was paying them to store rice for when there was like a emergency or something like that, and then they were just selling the rice.
No way.
Yes.
Oh my god.
And so it's one of those, like, they built these gigantic houses and then they went off to jail and now nobody lives in the gigantic house.
This is what's the name of the city again?
It's called Yuba City.
Yuba City, yeah. And it was voted the worst city by Rand McNally.
Yes.
I didn't know that Rand McNally was a real thing. I thought it was a thing that The Simpsons made up.
Oh, that's
so funny.
Isn't that
so weird? Yeah.
Well, it's always interesting to talk to people, like, the hegemony of our pop culture is something Americans don't understand. And even people, it's so funny, even people who, like, write for TV and stuff, like, one of the writers from Talk Show the Game Show was like, we get all these residuals, right? And he's like, where does this money even come from? And it's like, like, everything we write is, like, airing in Germany. And we don't think about that, you know?
Yeah.
But talking to Australians who were like, yeah, we know that Weeble Wobbles are something and they don't fall down, but we have no idea what they are.
Yeah.
Or, like, the pop culture references that we just sort of, like, throw out there.
Hot Pockets. We don't have that over here.
It's terrible.
No.
No, it's because I would say that, Britain and Ireland are much...
You're so good how you say Britain and Ireland. I love it.
You guys are much better at putting meat in dough than America is. Because America always thought that putting meat in dough was a factory's responsibility, where you guys had moms or grandmas who put meat in dough.
That's true. You like the Cornish pasty.
Yes.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. In Ireland, like, we have a thing called a spice bag, which is, like, mostly Chinese restaurants that make things for Westerners taste, so it's like more sweet or more kind of salty kind of stuff than actual Chinese food.
Yeah.
And there's this thing called spice bag, which is like pieces of breaded chicken, fries, onion and pepper, and then a lot of MSG and spice. It's a very big hangover food in Ireland.
That sounds terrifying and exciting at the same time.
That's exactly what a spice bag is. In my mouth, I'm terrified. I'm like, this will... I'm always like, actually, because I'm fat, and, like, sometimes when I eat, like, mad food, like, I'm always like, this will be the straw on the camel's back, Alison.
I mean,
it's always like, you know.
The extent to which you have to be self-conscious about letting other people feel like you're, like, putting proper effort into hating yourself and your body.
Totally.
Is really hard. And, like, the thing is the past two mornings, I have eaten full English breakfasts, and then, you know, I fucking I walked 15,000 steps yesterday, you know, yeah. Like it's going fine. I didn't have lunch. But the thing is I was so self-conscious about posting them to Instagram because I was like, well, then you're always worried that people are going to like look at it and be like, well, that's why, you know?
Totally. Or you get like, I always get like messages of like concerned men.
Yeah.
Where they're like, you know, you're pre-diabetic or whatever. And I'm like, fuck you. Do you know?
Right.
It's so odd. It's so odd that the foe, they're not really that upset for me.
No.
They don't care really whether I live or die or my knees blow out.
Well, like the thing is, they do care, but in a terrible way. Like they've decided that this needs to be their problem. It's just the most annoying thing on the planet. About a month ago, so like I had this wonderful doctor. I go to a clinic that's like all gay doctors and all gay male like patients, and like my old doctor was like wonderful and great and also had like slut tattoos and was clearly making a lot of wonderful bad choices on his own. And then he left to go to New York because his partner got a job. And then there was I had to get a new doctor, and I basically sat down with a dude who I showed up with a problem and all he wanted to talk to me about was bariatric surgery. And like couldn't even see me as a person. And it's just like, what are we doing here? And it was so funny to be at a place that was supposed to be like their tagline is doctors you can actually talk to, because they're used to dealing with gay guys and they're like, please talk to us about the unsafe sex and crystal meth that you've done, which is, a rich and important life of part of gay life. But it's also like, dude, why can't you just like learn what my job is before you decide that this needs to happen to me? And I also can't understand the extent to which once you add being a woman on that dudes feel the need to like little lady you.
That, and do you know what's weird as well is like I'll get people coming up to me and go, hey, it's so good that you're on the television, that like, being you. And I'm like, oh, what do you mean being fat? Is that it? And it's like, why, like if I had another job and I was fat, and I know like visibility is important and everything, but like it feels weird to have, it feels like a responsibility I don't want.
Well, it's also the way that like in becoming successful in entertainment you get to be famous for being you.
Yeah.
And like just some lady who works at a bank doesn't get that benefit, you know?
People
get to see her as an inconvenience. But I guess visibility is important because there is that way. Have you guys gotten a Marvelous Mrs. Maisel at all?
I have watched 4 episodes of it. It's the best TV show I've ever seen in my life. No competition.
It's truly wonderful, but just showing a New York in 1952 or whatever, where there are people of color, because for such a long time all of our representations of like the 50s were like super whitewashed in the way that movies from the 50s were, and it was so easy to forget like, no, this is a diverse country, it's always been a diverse country. And just sort of the way that or like I was watching the new Netflix series of She-Ra, and when I was growing up, She-Ra's He-Man's like cousin or whatever.
Okay.
But the thing is like they were all Barbie doll images, and now they're like women with different body shapes.
Wow.
And just sort of realizing that mind fuck of entertainment showing you, well, this is what human beings are, you know? And if there's no one who is outside of this like cookie cutter, like white, like reduced concept of what humanity is, we all learn that that's what a person is. In the same, I was going to make a comment about how like 80% of words spoken in movies are by men, and that makes it harder to understand women's perspectives. But then I realized I was a man who had been talking for a really long time.
It's just odd because, like, sometimes I just want to be like normal, as in like to not be a polarizing figure for people.
Uh-huh.
Because like there's people that really like me because I am who I am, but there's people that really dislike me, and like some of my colleagues who are not fat or not women, and there's no negative or positive thing. It's just like, oh, they're good at what they do.
Yeah,
do you know. But meanwhile, like, I feel like I either fail on behalf of fat women or, do you know what I mean? But I do it myself to other, I watch quiz shows and I always root for the fattest person on the quiz show. I'm always like, they need it more than those other fuckers. Yeah, sorry, I'm just talking about myself. I should talk more about you.
Oh no, but I want to make a point, okay?
Yes.
All right, I forget whether it was on, we were being recorded or not, but I talked about my deep love of Only Connect.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the great tragedy is that I could never be on Only Connect because I don't know what a Blue Peter presenter is.
So
I feel like there was a really awesome episode where they had a girl on who was blind and she was able to use, like, I think she had Braille and she had things in her ears so that, like, visual things would be communicated to her.
Wow.
And I feel like I should get some sort of equipment to deal with the fact that I don't know what Blue Peter presenters are.
To
like make up for my disabilities.
Or Carnation Street. So,
there have been a couple of times where I was able to smell it enough to be like, I think that's something about EastEnders.
Really? Oh my God. Have you ever seen an episode?
No. Though there were there was a period of time when my local TV station for like 1 year played Neighbors in the afternoon because they were trying to make Neighbors happen.
Really?
And that didn't happen.
It never kicked off.
Though, did you grow up was Neighbors a thing?
Neighbors was a thing. Home and Away was more of a thing in Ireland.
Oh, okay.
Did you ever hear Home and Away?
Yes. I met a dude who had written for Home and Away for an extended period of time, and we had a weird flirtation.
Nice.
But
I'm happy for you.
The thing about Los Angeles, the reason I live in West Hollywood in Los Angeles is because Australia, a nation of like 20 million hot people who have all been in the Olympics.
Yes.
They select their hottest people, and then they put them on Neighbors or Home and Away for 2 seasons as the new hot guy. And then they all move to my neighborhood in Los Angeles and try to make it as actors.
Beautiful.
And some of them make it as actors and some of them just work at my gym. But what's important is that like the masturbatory fantasies of a generation of Australian gay boys are just like floating around where I live.
They're just in your peripheral vision all the time.
It's very important.
Oh, who's, what's your neighbors like generally in it? Like, who's the most famous person you live beside? I am such a shithead for this type of shit.
That's wonderful. There was a period of time when Annette Bening and I just had this weird, like, lifestyle overlap where I was just in the same place as her at all times.
Oh, my gosh.
But no, better answers are like...
No, that's a good one. Don't matter.
But the thing is like, do you know what The Biggest Loser is?
I do, yeah.
I mean, it's a terrible show. But Bob Harper, the, like, guy who... He's a gay guy who's a personal trainer. He's at my cafe all the time.
How does he look at you?
Oh, the thing is like, because I was gay famous at the same time he was becoming gay famous, he was perfectly nice about it. He was always very lovely to me, and that's why. So Bob had a heart attack, and part of me thought that there was great irony that this person who spent his career yelling at fat people about how they were going to have a heart attack had a heart attack.
Yeah.
But also, he was a very nice man to me. And so I didn't say anything.
So you couldn't have that juicy bit of like...
Because I think one of the things is that feeling like an outsider, I was very inclined, and like in a very catty gay way, to just sort of like tear at things.
Yeah. And because they would tear at you first.
Yes. And because it gave me a sense of power, in the face of powerlessness and having to realize like, guy, you're fine. Like, you get to be on television. Your opinions are out there. You don't need to just attack things.
Yeah.
You know, you're allowed to be, like, nice and thoughtful. It's very hard, though.
And plus, you'd meet those people. I don't know, like, because you wrote for Joan Rivers. Have you ever met people that you've written jokes about and they know?
Oh, well, it's very funny because, like, I was in the process of becoming friends with Natalie Portman.
Oh, no.
And then... And then sort of like my career a little bit tanked and I had to work for Fashion Police, which should be a great job, but wasn't a great job because of a weird combination of like systemic sexism and the fact that Joan Rivers wanted to live in 1964 where you have 15 joke writers who you pay a couple of $100 to as opposed to sort of like employing people and giving them healthcare. The thing is, Joan was amazing, but Joan was like so... so much came from this place of like, I'm never going to be one of the glamorous ones. So I will spend my life tearing at the glamorous ones.
But yet she looked so glamorous.
Yes. Yeah. And she like couldn't see that and couldn't understand it. And one of the things that was most amazing is, but the thing is it comes down to, did I write shitty jokes about Natalie Portman? Absolutely. you know?
Yeah.
Not shitty, but just sort of like, nah, I didn't like this outfit. Because it also, it makes me sad because I grew up really loving sort of like Fashion Police and that kind of thing. And I also think that there does need to be space for sort of like, I mean, that is women's version of roast battle. And yeah. I don't like that it gets just sort of like uniformly denigrated. I think there were things about it that were bad. But one thing that happened was Joan couldn't understand Lena Dunham. Like, she like looked at this chubby Jewish girl who should have feared her. She, like, Joan was like, I hate myself at this level. That girl should hate herself more. Why does she not hate herself? And watching her sort of like wrestle with that and sort of like make fun of her on the show, but really sort of like not understand it. And then after Joan died, I did just like reach out and DM Lena Dunham and sort of say like, hey, you need to understand that this woman who talks shit about you, it was partially because she couldn't understand how much you were made possible by someone like her. Like, yeah. You know, that like she was in awe of Lena Dunham's strength and tenacity, you know, and really couldn't understand it. And it was sweet and hard to watch, but also fucking amazing to watch an 83-year-old woman be that capable and that on top of things and like working that hard to understand all of the pop culture references. Like, let's all hope that we're as together and with it at 83 as Joan was.
It weirds me out to think of Joan as a person with, no, in a good way, but like, you know, not weirds me out, but it's nice to, I knew she had low self-esteem in a way because of like the type of comedy she does.
Yeah.
But, that's crazy.
I forget whether it's in the book, but just the experience of, because we did this all at Melissa's house, like underneath the Passover dishes. So like, we would sometimes be driving to work and then we would all get a call that was like, hey, Joan and Melissa are fighting. Can you guys not come for another 20 minutes? And then all of the writers would end up at the Safeway. Safeway is a supermarket.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But a Safeway like perched over the Pacific Ocean. Like a Safeway that's on $10 million of real estate.
Oh my gosh.
And then we would all just be like sitting there like drinking a Diet Pepsi being like, yeah, when do you think they're going to be through this? Like her humanity was just so at the forefront that it's weird in comedy and we're having this conversation about how much are people supposed to be like honest? How much are they supposed to be like trying to do the right thing? And there was something that was always so beautiful about the fact that like Joan's messiness was right in front of you to be seen. She fucking starred in a TV movie.
Yes.
About her husband's suicide.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Try criticizing that person.
No, you cannot. That's indestructible. That's incredible. Yeah. I looked at the time and then I was like, you've been so great to me.
You've been so great to me. Thanks so much for having me. And
yeah,
also,
yeah.
Allison, I look forward to you showing up in Los Angeles. I'm going to show you some real... Oh, and also...
Yeah, I really want to try funnel cakes since you described it. It sounds incredible.
I mean, funnel cakes are really good. I don't know. Ireland and Britain are really good at frying things. But it's pretty good. But let me tell you, when it comes to seeing celebrities, here's what no one's going to tell you. The people can go on their fucking bus tours all day long. You want to know what you do?
Yeah.
Just go to the West Hollywood Whole Foods.
Really?
And just, like, shop on, like, a Saturday. And, like, you're gonna see Jason Statham. I realize that's a British celebrity, so it's less impressive.
No, I'm impressed.
But, like, you're just going to see so many incidental celebrities doing their thing. That's it's lovely. They're in their natural habitat.
Yeah, I just can't imagine like Jason Statham kind of looking at cashews and you know and getting the cheapest or whatever.
It's one time. Again, I forget if this was in the book. I should have.
I'll probably tell you.
But like I lived on the West Side and I would always go shopping at like 2 or 3 in the morning. And one time I just saw Cuba Gooding Jr. with like 12 chicken pot pies, like frozen chicken pot pies. And it was like, that's wonderful. That is Los Angeles.
I wonder what occasion he was having.
I think there was just a sale, but it's also the sadness of like, this means that Cuba Gooding Jr. is having to defrost his own dinner.
That's beautiful. That's I actually want to ask you, like, what's it been like since you've brought out your book? Because what I loved about it, sorry, I know this is the last question, but what I loved about it was so honest. Like, there was parts where you were talking about the end of Chelsea, the talk show, and you were like, well, you kind of did not, you didn't gloss over what you felt you did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you were really more than fair to every, it felt like I was having a conversation with someone who's thought about it a lot,
yeah,
and is able to like give the other person's side and not, because if I would have been relaying that story, I'd be like, fuck her and fuck Tim and I was late once, or you know, that kind of thing.
The thing is that
that's why you should get the book, guys.
Yes, my book, My Life as a Goddess, available wherever books are sold.
And Audible. It's very good.
But you always try to like give the other person's perspective benefit of the doubt, but it's going on in your own head, so you're never going to be able to do it completely. But like, I tried to, and the thing that was most important to me, my mom like doesn't pay attention to anything that I yeah. do, but I wanted her,
my dad does that, holler.
I wanted her to like listen to, because she listened to it on Audible as well, listen to the chapter where it talks about my dad. The only thing I was really worried about is if she thought I was, because my dad wasn't there to be mad at me about it, you know, whether she thought that I was being fair and she was cool about that. There was one girl from my hometown who actually, I believe, lost her house in the current fires. But she
was, I don't know why I left there, sorry.
No, it's true. Okay. But she was like lovely and supportive about the book, but I went on Conan and I made fun of my hometown, and she was like, that was going a little far. And I understand that that's other people's perspectives, but like, most everybody's been cool about it. There are a couple of people who I like only realized afterwards, like I probably should have checked with them.
Yeah.
Before I like dished, said that about them. But like, nobody's really expressed, like it's only been strangers who were like saying like, he's a creep because he catfished that dude in Minnesota or yeah. whatever. And it's like, well, that's my fucking truth. You know,
I'm
not saying I was a great person. I'm saying this is who I was. And also, I hope I learned some lessons from it.
Yeah, no, that's what I liked about the book. And also, because I talk about my hometown a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't necessarily, I always felt like an outsider.
Yeah.
So, and it was rural. It's a rural yeah. hometown. And like, the people who I cared about didn't have any problem with it. But it was people that were like peripheral people.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, are you supposed to have an opinion on my town?
Right.
Really? Well, like,
but I mean, that's so interesting because
yeah.
like my town essentially doesn't pay attention to me and it's very easy. But like you had a TV show in Ireland that was about your hometown. They can't fucking avoid that. Like was the hometown newspaper proud of you? Or?
Yeah, I'm on their Wikipedia page. There's like a little segment I've looked up. They are, and they've been like, my mum is like super happy because I think she's really gone into the community a lot more
uh-huh.
since the TV show. As in, like, she's proud of me and they're proud. And then she's like, she's going to the pub a lot more and
yeah.
socializing with people, which is quite nice.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
It is cool. So, like, and that's, and it, those people are nice. It's the other people that are not really.
Like, my hometown is.
How's your home? Yeah.
Mostly just, they wish I was like an MMA fighter. Like, if
right.
I had played like half a season in the majors, they would be like, baseball.
They
would be like, oh, Guy Branum is from Yuba City. Where, like, you know, me being like a gay Jew liberal who has a TV show, they're like, that doesn't represent us. And that is so weird because, like, it's hard. It's weird to figure out what kind of relationship I'm supposed to have with this place. If this place says, you're not like us. And I'm like, I know. It was very awkward. But also, here's what I want to emphasize to you, Allison Spittle.
Yes.
Is that today, when I went to type California into my search engine so that I could figure out what the distance or the total area of California compared to Britain was, the predictive text put California dried plum board. Because that is the primary industry of my hometown.
Yeah.
And so my commitment and my love to Sutter County, California should really be exemplified by the way that its agricultural products and their marketing are in my computer.
Yeah, and they're also in your book. You say like you say the place called it smells of like decaying prunes, which sounds lovely in a way, you know?
I mean, the thing is that it is this strange, it's like somewhere between fragrant fruit, yeah, alcohol and shit. What's your town?
Ballymore. Means big town in Gaelic. It's not big.
Do you speak Irish?
A little, yeah. Conasatatu.
What does that mean?
Means how are you? I'm willing kiadag and goji on leheris mash na halle, which means, can I go to the toilet, please? You had to learn that in school. You couldn't go to the toilet unless you asked in Gaelic.
Does it ever come up?
Which, the...
Irish.
Not in day-to-day life.
At Bally what?
Ballymore.
What does Ballymore do? Like, what is...
What's his main industry?
Yes.
Cattle. I'd say cattle. Yeah.
Yes.
Like, I come from like social housing in the middle of this small rural village, and there'd be a lot of cattle around. And there's also this Jacobite watchtower, which used to look for the British. And there was a horrible massacre there 500 years ago.
Ireland seems like
pubs. There's 7 pubs there.
Oh, like bars. Pubs are a thing that I need to understand better. I have not gone and properly participated in, but just it's so weird that like every little, and I realize I'm in Soho, so I'm not seeing the actual experience of Britain, but like that all of your bars are so quaint. Aggressive sort of like, it's this entire culture and way of life that I don't understand. But Ireland, here's the thing. The colonialism there happened so long and between white people that there, it's so easy to ignore this weird and very different culture that exists underneath it.
Yeah.
And I would love to understand that better.
I will totally. Let's goodbye.
So that was Guy Branum. He's fantastic. And thank you so much for listening. I've been thinking a lot about the podcast lately, and it's nice to have you as an audience. There's loads of other podcasts available at the moment, and I want to make the podcast as good as possible in the new year. So if you've got any suggestions of who I should interview, whether it be in Ireland or England, go for it. And I'll try and get them on. I got some stuff to promote. I've written a play called Starlet, which I'll have a chat with you actually after I just do the dates, if that's okay. So the 19th and the 20th, Starlet is going to be on in Smock Alley. It stars Peter McGann and Roxana Nicklean, and it's directed by Simon Mulholland. So there are great people involved, and I'm very, very excited about it. Also, I'm doing my tour, and if you've seen me on tour so far, I've had the lovely Aidan Green as my tour support, and he's fantastic, and go check him out. But now for the next little while, I'm going to have Julie J. as my support. She's fantastic. Also, if you're listening to this fresh on a Wednesday, Garrod Farley has got a new show out in Smock Alley, and you should go to that and listen to his podcast as well. It's very good. Fascinated. I really enjoy it. But Julie J is going to join me on the 8th and 9th of February. I'm going to be in Greystones on the 9th of February and Waterford on the 8th of February. There are very little tickets left for Waterford. Last time I checked, there was 8 tickets left. And I don't know how, I think I might sell out. Don't want to toot my own horn, but it's a few days to go. At Greystones, we got like 40 tickets left, so that's not going to sell out. So just buy tickets if you want, and it's going to be a great night because I love that that venue. Then on the 15th of February, I'm going to be in Blanchard Sound. That's sold out. On the 16th of February, I'm in Belfast, but that's sold out as well. On the 22nd of February, I have Limerick. Limerick has, like, I think 3 tickets left, so that'll sell out quick. So get yourself into Limerick. And then Mullingar. Oh, Mullingar, my hometown. I said yes to doing Mullingar, but I didn't look at the capacity. The capacity is 400. That is nearly half of Vicar Street. That is crazy. The last time I gigged in the Mullingar Arts Centre, I was 11 years old, and I played a version of Al Capone in a musical number as a part of a drama club's performance at the end of the year, and I made a great Al Capone. But yeah, buy tickets for Mullingar. There are hundreds of tickets left for that gig. Hundreds. So also, interesting fact, if you've never been to Mullingar Arts Centre, before it was a wonderful place for the performing arts, it was a place where they used to hang criminals. So, you know, you'll get a bit of history there as well. Then moving into March, we got Clonakilty on the 21st of March. And there's a few tickets left for that. Now, Cork is sold out. That's on the 22nd of March. And I'm doing a second show in Cork, and it's going to be in Coughlin's at 7:30. So I'm doing 2 shows that night to accommodate all the Cork people. So if you missed out on tickets for the 9 o'clock show, you can get the 7:30 show there, and we'll have a great time. And then on the 29th of March, it's mad. People are buying tickets for this. Glasgow Comedy Festival. I'm doing my show, Makes a Show of Herself, at Glasgow Comedy Festival. And then on the 30th of March, I'm going to be in Vicar Street. And I'm very excited about that. That's selling grand. I'm not too worried about that. But buy tickets, because I see other people selling out, and I'm jealous, I won't lie. Yeah, so that's really it with the promotion of the tour. And so I'll tell you what I'm up to generally. I'm trying to write a new show that's newer than Makes a Show of Herself, and it's called Alison Spittle, Mother of Christ, and I hope to bring that to Edinburgh. And what it's about is the Virgin Mary. I've always kind of been a bit obsessed with her, and I want to write a show about her. So that's what I'm up to. You can get tickets for the Edinburgh show soon enough as well, and it's very exciting. Now, I might be doing some previews of that in Smock Alley. I'm not sure if to get the dates correct, but if you listen to the next podcast, we'll be grand. Now, what I was going to talk to you properly about was Starlet. And this is just an extra content at the end of a podcast and a quick chat. Starlet is actually inspired by one of the stories I told on this podcast. And I won't tell you which one, just in case you come to see it, but you probably can guess if you, anyway. It was inspired by one of the stories I told, and I'm changing around details because it's a play, and I want to be a playwright. But it's pretty exciting to give, you know, actors your script, and also, you know, with television it's high pressure. And with the play, it's high pressure, but there's no one putting forward your stuff more so than yourself. You know, you're putting forward your ideas, and it's getting made. And we're making like half a car for the stage, and I, because like it costs so much money to put on plays, like you have to get rehearsal space, and there's so much stuff I didn't account for and that I'm kind of taking care of. And I'm looking up like fashion from 2007, because it's around the time, it's around 2007 when this event happened. And I wanted to make it like a period piece of the mid 2000s. So I'm going through music that I liked when I was, you know, around in 2007. And I'm looking up Kiss magazine and different types of fashion from back then. So it's kind of fun and interesting. You should come along to the show, and I hope to make it a longer show and kind of maybe like tour it or do something with it anyway. But yeah, come along. I hope this was fun for you. Thank you very much to Sarah Garvey, who makes the show. Thank you very much to Alan and Paddy from Head Stuff, who accommodate the show so well. Thank you very much to Bobby Ahern, who did a fantastic song for the show, and William Conway, who did the lovely artwork for this show. I hope you have a lovely day. Seriously, I'm really open to suggestions about who to have. And I remember back in the day, I used to have like the hashtag apricot party and stuff. And I just want to bring it back and be better this year and have a nice time. Yeah, I'll let you go. Have a lovely day. Bye.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.